Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, June 27th, 2025, and our friend Dmitry Orlov is back with us. Welcome back, Dmitry.
Great to be with you again.
Before starting, Dmitry, let us know how can we support you and how can we access the article that you write on your web blog or website?
Go to the website Boosty, boosty.to/club-orlov. And subscribe, and then you'll have access to my articles, such as the one I'm going to publish this weekend about how the recent 12-day war was an Iranian victory and also a victory for Russia and China and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and a defeat for the United States, for Israel, and for NATO.
I hope everybody goes there, and I every time I read the articles of Dmitry, I found something new, and you have to go there and find, and because he writes so well, in my opinion. Dmitry, let's get started with what has happened.
Thank you.
Let's get started with what has happened between Iran and Israel. We had Israeli attack, then the United States joined Israel in their attack. I don't know, somehow to continue or to finalize the attacks. Can you hear me, Dmitry?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. With what has happened so far, Dmitry, what's your take on the situation between Iran and Israel? Donald Trump is talking about ceasefire. It's we can call it some sort of cessation, what's going on. But what's your take on what has happened?
Well, it was, it started out with the Ukrainian defeat. Everybody in Washington now realizes that the Ukraine is lost. They want to extricate themselves out of the Ukrainian mess. They don't want to give any more money to the Kiev regime, knowing that at least half of it gets stolen. They don't have any more weapons to give to the Ukrainians, and really neither do the Europeans. So the Ukraine becomes Russia's problem. And everybody now realizes, even though they can't politically say it, that they need good relations with Russia. They don't need good relations with the Ukraine because the Ukraine doesn't produce anything of value except maybe refugees. So realizing that there's this gigantic defeat and that saying that it's Biden's war, that Trump had nothing to do with it, et cetera, that ruse is wearing a bit thin. What Trump really needs is a victory, a military victory. So Bibi Netanyahu stepped in and said, we have this regime change operation running in Tehran. Why don't I take care of it for you? And then we can claim victory together over Iran. There'd be accolades for us, and you'd get the Nobel Peace Prize, and I would eliminate this Zionist-hating entity, which is really embarrassing for Israel because Iran is pro-Jewish but anti-Israeli. Very, very awkward situation to be in. Lots of Jews in Iran who live there comfortably and even are represented in the Iranian parliament and have been for thousands of years living on that land and are part of the landscape. So Trump went for it, said, Bibi, go ahead and attack and stop, launch your operation. We'll have a regime change. We'll line up this new Shah of Iran, who is the son of the old clan. Everything will be wonderful. And of course, none of it worked. It just plain didn't work. So then Trump thought about it a little bit more and thought, well, how can I at least claim credit for something? How about destroying the non-existent Iranian nuclear weapon program. Because if Iran had nuclear weapons, that would be just a gigantic threat, you know, just like Israel having nuclear weapons is a gigantic threat, not really. Just like the United States having nuclear weapons is a gigantic threat to someone, not sure who. So they launched this attack, and they bombed the entrances to the tunnels leading to an underground cavern, the depth of which is unknown. It's under layers and layers of basalt. And they dropped some bombs that are designed to penetrate maybe 60 meters into loam or sand or something like that, but not through basalt. They can go through concrete, reinforced concrete, a few layers of it. But what they did was they bombed into rubble the entrances to the to these tunnels. And the funny thing is that the enriched uranium that the Iranians had, maybe 500, 600 kilos of it, had been evacuated from the facility beforehand. So it was all just shadow boxing. But it gave Trump a chance to declare victory, notwithstanding the fact that Iran had bombed the largest army base, military base that the United States has in the region. And it did it very delicately. You know, it told people to evacuate, then it sent it in just a few missiles, and just one or two or three of those missiles got through, just to sort of put a fine point on it that, you know, if we want to kill Americans, we can, but we don't really want to. And that was the end of the whole thing. So big pieces of Haifa and Tel Aviv have been reduced to rubble. The estimates for the damage, you know, the low estimate from the Israelis is maybe $12 billion. The high estimate from some guest on some talk show, don't remember who it was, but he said it's $500 billion. In that tone of voice, I recall. So the truth is somewhere in between, but Israel has been pretty heavily damaged. And what's more, their whole plan just completely collapsed. No more regime change in Iran. Forget about it.
Dmitry, do you feel that the ceasefire, what Donald Trump is calling ceasefire, we didn't have any sort of paper to be signed, any sort of robust articles to be agreed on, but Donald Trump calls it ceasefire. How is that? Is that fragile in your opinion?
Well, what good are robust articles signed by people who habitually lie? Constantly lie. I mean, Trump lied about the Iranian nuclear program. You know, his own 18 intelligence agencies told him that there's no weapons program in Iran. His IAEA, which is pretty much a Western organization run by an Italian, said that there is no nuclear weapons program in Iran. But he doesn't believe them because he wanted to have this Top Gun campaign flying in B-2s and dropping bunker busters. And of course, once everyone realized that it was all a lie, it won't matter anymore because the news cycle will go around one more time and there'll be some new stupid thing for people to pay attention to.
Do you know why there is some sort of huge disagreement within the United States? Because Donald Trump says that we have totally obliterated the Iranian nuclear program. And on the other hand, the mainstream media tries to go against him. What is going on internally in the United States in terms of what has happened between Iran and the United States?
Well, if you have an argument about something that doesn't exist, then you can pretty much say anything and be right. So Trump did destroy a non-existent Iranian weapons program, and he didn't destroy it because it doesn't exist. So both sides are right. and they can just tear each other's hair out for all I care. You know, they can gouge each other's eyeballs out. I'd love that. And it's still about nothing.
You've mentioned that the situation in the Middle East, what has happened between Iran and Israel and the United States being involved as well, was somehow a strategic defeat. Was that a strategic defeat for the United States and Israel, or the United States under the Trump administration managed to gain something, to put pressure somehow? We know that the Zionist lobby in the United States is so powerful, is so strong. And when it comes to the way that Donald Trump wants to deal with the situation in the Middle East, do you think that the war between Iran and Israel put Israel in a weaker position, the way that Donald Trump would be more capable of dealing with Netanyahu and his administration?
Well, look, the power of the Israeli lobby in the United States is at the same time difficult to overstate and easy to overstate. It's very powerful, right? Some people say they own, or they bribed basically half of U.S. Congress. There's this AI pack that gets together once a year or so, and it's just kind of a celebration of that whole scheme, corruption scheme. But on the other hand, which lobby is more powerful, the Israeli lobby or the Arab lobby, the Middle Eastern Gulf Arab lobby? I mean, Trump was just over there begging for money, and he did get some money. So how much money can Israel offer? A negative sum? Israel is a public money sponge. It cannot exist without constant infusions of capital and weapons from the United States. Now, what good is it? It promised regime change in Iran. Did it deliver? No, it did not. Instead, what happened is it created a whole wall of new martyrs, and Iranians are all about martyrs. You know, it's the more martyrs, the more powerful it becomes. There was an urban population in Iran that was pro rapprochement with the West. They really wanted to merge with the West, and you know, hand out liquor licenses to their friends instead of just smuggling stuff from Armenia, they wanted all of that. They didn't want to cover their heads, the women, that is, and they really didn't like this radical, quote unquote radical, sort of Shia Islam. But now these people have been silenced. What's more, Israel has been cultivating, because there are so many Jews living in Iran, cultivating connections and sleeper agents. And all of these sleeper agents have been outed. There was also a lot of Afghani refugees living in Iran who were bought for very little money to form some kind of like a terrorist, bunch of terrorist cells to attack the government. All of those have been outed. This gave the Iranians a really good chance to clean house. The pro-Western Iranians have two choices now. One is to flee to the West, where they will be completely disregarded because they're now useless within Iran itself, or they switch sides, which is what a lot of them are doing. Pezeshkian people who were all about appeasing the West and making peace are pretty much, you know, abandoning that cause because it's an unreasonable cause at this point. And the other thing is that the Israelis turned to political assassination and assassinated a bunch of senior Israelis. And the fact that they're senior is pretty important because these people were involved with the war against the U.S.-sponsored war against Iraq. Iraq at the time was basically a U.S. proxy in the region attacking Iran.
You meant senior Iranian commanders.
Senior Iranian, Yes. These senior Iranians that have been killed were people who were interested in avoiding war because a lot of lives were lost in that conflict. So they've been killed. They've been replaced by younger people who are much more radical and much more willing to sustain the idea of supreme sacrifice. And they will be in charge of Iran for the next generation. So Israel basically did itself and did the United States, in terms of limiting Iran's power, an extreme disservice. The people who basically abandoned Hezbollah and abandoned Hamas and abandoned Syria because they wanted to be nice to the Europeans and the Americans and make peace with them and have sanctions lifted, please, please lift the sanctions, etc. They now realize that you know, these are not their friends and will never be their friends. And of course, immediately the foreign minister of Iran flew to Moscow because that's where their real friends are. And now their discussions with an SCO, lessons learned from this Israeli attack on Iran. And they'll draw conclusions from it and will rearm Iran so that it is no longer possible to attack it in this manner.
What's somehow fascinating when it comes to the conflict both in Ukraine and in Iran, when the West started the conflict in Ukraine, they said that this is Putin's war, this is not Russia's war. They tried to draw a line between the Russian people and the Russian leadership, the Russian president. The same has happened in what has in the conflict between Iran and Israel. It seems that they didn't learn from Russia. After 3 years of the conflict, more than 3 years of the conflict in Ukraine, as time goes by, the society in Russia is getting more unified, it's getting more supportive of the administration of the president of Russia and their policy toward what's going on with the West. It came the same way when you look at Iran. They tried to do regime change. They tried to do everything. Look at the position they brought in. They tried to, most of these Iranian programs outside of Iran are supported, they've supported Israel and the United States in their action in their war against Iran. They wanted to make some sort of division. The same thing, it doesn't seem that the West is capable of learning. There is no learning curve when it comes to the color revolution, somehow forcing the people of those countries to go against the leadership, to go against the president, the government. Is that going to change? Are they going to learn from these two cases?
Well, let me put on my clinical psychiatrist hat and ask a simple question. Is idiocy treatable or curable? You have some doctor friends probably, right? Ask one of them, is idiocy treatable or curable? Very simple question. I think that answers your entire question. So drawing a line between Putin and the Russian population, over 80% of which supports Putin, is that a smart move? Same thing with with the Ayatollah. The line is somewhere else, but I think it's 60, 65, maybe 70%, which has now shot up to over 80 support. Same idea. So basically, when you attack Putin, you attack Russia. When you attack the Ayatollah, you attack Iran. So is attacking these two gigantic, ancient, very well-armed and motivated countries, is that a good idea if you aren't going to introduce ground troops? So for instance, if you wanted regime change in Russia, you'd need to introduce maybe 5, 6, 7 million troops. Who has that many? Nobody. If you wanted regime change in Iran, you would have to introduce 1 million ground troops. Is anybody ready to do that? nobody. So these are just basically mouths flapping. You know, these people have to somehow earn their keep. And the way they do it is by producing truly idiotic ideas. So that is not going to change. It's going to continue, and it's going to become ever more ridiculous.
Has the situation with Iran, has, did it, you've mentioned Donald Trump went to the Middle East, to the West Asia, with visiting the Arab states. I was wondering when this war started, I was wondering why did the United States decide to be involved in the war while Donald Trump went to the Arab states? He didn't visit Israel. And with all those investments, all those monies he got from the Arab states, then the only thing they've been asking Donald Trump, they are not interested in a direct war between Iran and the United States, because that would influence their countries, their situation in the Middle East. Do you think that had some sort of importance in the decision that Donald Trump made during the conflict between Iran and Israel?
Well, I think that he was very careful not to upset the Arabs. I think that he was very careful to paint this as a strategic move to bomb a couple of sites. And as soon as there were missiles fired at Doha, I believe it was, he started talking about peace. And that was a kind of an interesting coincidence, because that was the moment in time when Bibi Netanyahu started screaming because Iran was getting ready to destroy the electric grid in Iran, which would basically demolish the Israeli economy. He wasn't ready for that. And at that point, Israel was completely defenseless. So its Iron Dome and its other defense systems were depleted, in spite of a few rockets that had been flown in from the Ukraine. The Ukraine has been stripped of air defense systems, by the way, just to sustain Israel, or try to sustain Israel. And then a lot of the stuff that the Iranians threw at Israel, were throwing at Israel, were being intercepted by American and British ships in the Mediterranean. So it wasn't Israeli air defense system that was functioning. It was this joint force that was deployed in the region. And even that couldn't stop a lot of the missiles. So Iran proved that it has the technology to penetrate the missile shields of the West, anything that the West has. And so at that point, Bibi Netanyahu went critical and called Trump and said, please make it stop. Please, please do something to make it stop. And that's where that's where Trump puffed out his chest more than ever before and said, I'm a peacemaker. There will now be peace. Give me the Nobel Peace Prize. And there wasn't peace, so he swore. He used the F word, and then there was peace. The F word really worked. And so that was it. Iran said, okay, mission accomplished. We humiliated the enemy. The damage that we sustained is reasonable. Israel has been humiliated. United States is in a world of its own. It's useless to talk to, so we won't be making any more deals with them. And then Trump turns around and says to Iran, can we please buy your centrifuges if you still have any? Because we need your uranium enrichment technology. We don't have any of our own. You see, the United States needs enriched uranium. They're about to restart their nuclear energy program because they're becoming desperate. And they can't do it without Iranian centrifuges. Iran has this technology. The United States doesn't.
Do you, with what has happened, with what you mentioned about the situation between Iran and Israel, do you feel that Israel would attack Iran again? What was the experience for them, and what would be the outcome of this war, this 12 day war between the two countries, how convincing that would be for the Israeli society to go against Iran again?
Well, remember what I said about idiocy. There's no accounting for idiocy. So it's a form of insanity to try something over and over again and expect a different result each time. I don't think that the situation has changed, except that I don't think that the Americans would be so eager to go in there and try to shoot down Iranian missiles. They just basically let Israel twist in the wind at this point. It's becoming too expensive a project. You know, they just squandered all their money on the Ukraine, which was a complete disaster. And now Israel is a bit of a disaster too. You know, it needs a lot of rebuilding. A lot of the prime assets have been severely damaged or destroyed. And so Israel is becoming kind of a suitcase without a handle. What do they need Israel for? Israel was necessary when the United States was practically at war with all the Arabs in the region. That is no longer the case. Nobody really cares to fight the United States, and the United States doesn't care to fight anyone particularly, except for, you know, these propaganda stunts like regime change in Iran. But other than that, there's nothing going on. So why do they need to support Israel if Israel is going to misbehave in a ridiculous fashion?
We had Donald Trump at the NATO summit talking about the Patriot system being transferred to Israel, not to Ukraine, when he was asked by a Ukrainian reporter, and she was working for BBC. When Donald Trump talks about the case of Ukraine, do you think that the priority of Ukraine is fading away? It's just diminishing?
Well, he was talking about the Patriot missiles. The batteries, yeah, right? They're very expensive, and they're very expensive to maintain. And Americans get a lot of money for maintaining them and selling parts, etc., training, whatever, upkeep. Now, the problem is that the moment they pop those batteries into the Ukraine, the Russians just destroy them. I lost count of how many Patriot missile batteries got destroyed in the Ukraine, but the Russians basically see them coming and blow them up. So you can't sell parts to something that's been destroyed. You can't train crews on something that's been destroyed. You can't sell those rockets that are, I think, 2 million a pop to a non-existent missile battery. But in Israel, they'll be safe. In Israel, they'll just be sitting out there in the desert and nobody will mind them. They will rust and they'll need maintenance and upkeep, etc., and the contractor that makes them will be happy, and Trump will be happy.
How did you find the NATO summit? What was the outcome of Daddy being at the NATO summit? He was called Daddy by the NATO Secretary General, and I don't know if Daddy wants to help them in their continuous hatred toward Russia and the case of Ukraine. Do you feel that Donald Trump, we know that he was incapable, literally incapable of doing anything important when it comes to Ukraine. He talks, and nothing comes out. As he usually say, all talk, no action. But when it comes to the outcome of their action, the United States decisions in the last 6 months, is that going to send a message to NATO, to the countries like Germany, France, and the United Kingdom who are desperate to continue the conflict with Russia?
Well, they're not desperate to continue the conflict with Russia because they don't really have a conflict with Russia. Basically squandering money on the Ukrainians, and half of that money is stolen. They don't have any more weapons to give to the Ukrainians. They have a lot of these lightly armored vehicles that they built for anti-terrorism campaigns in the Middle East that the Russians can just basically, I think machine gun bullets go through them and kill the crew inside. So they're not really useful for anything. Russians have lots of cheap drones to knock them out, but that's all they have. That's all they have left. Maybe they can scare up some Bradleys or some other armored personnel carriers that are a little bit harder for the Russians to kill. But the Russians have destroyed half of everything, all the armor that NATO has given the Ukrainians, and so it's all kind of silly. They don't have anything more to give to the Ukrainians, that, and certainly they don't have the ability to change what's going on, the overall dynamic. What they can't have is Russia going from enemy to friend. That would undermine their entire game. At that point, they pretty much should immediately resign and go do something else, a little bit of gardening or something, or start a cooking show on television. Because at that point, their entire shtick is over. They no longer have a line of goods to sell to their own constituents, and they look ridiculous. And what Trump really wants more than anything else is for Russia to be America's friend. He really needs Russia for a lot of different things. There's a whole list of joint projects that the Americans absolutely need, and Russia wouldn't mind. Americans want nuclear reactors. Who is the prime builder of nuclear reactors in the world for export? It's Rosatom in Russia. So if they can't get Rosatom on their side, they don't have anything. They're not in the game. That's pretty important. They also have to start exploring for oil in the Arctic, on the Arctic shelf. They can't do that without Russia's help. Russia is the only country that has the atomic icebreaker fleet that can make such an operation possible. Those are only two examples, but there are lots of others where the United States needs Russia. The United States does not need Europe for anything at this point.
During the conflict, Dmitry, between Iran and Israel, it came to a moment that Iran was considering to close the Strait of Hormuz. And Donald Trump tweeted that we have to produce more petroleum, more oil, and go after that and find some sort of solution for that. Is the United States capable of providing or somehow producing more oil in terms of to balance the loss of oil if something happens in the Strait of Hormuz or maybe in Bab el-Mandab in the Red Sea with the Yemenis?
Oh, that's an easy question. The answer is no. There's really no need to elaborate. It's just no. Russia could maybe ramp up its production a little bit. The United States cannot ramp up its production, no matter at this point. Well, maybe a little bit, but not enough to make a difference.
Yeah. How the situation with NATO summit, how was Zelensky? We know that Zelensky somehow within the European Union, they had some sort of differences before all this chaos happening in Ukraine. But with the case of Ukraine and with the new administration in the United States, it seems that the problems within the European Union is growing and growing bigger. And I don't see Donald Trump being interested in interfering in the European Union. And they are creating the case of Ukraine, which is not part of Europe, which is not part of the European Union, as the existential case for Europe. Is that the end, in your opinion, for the European Union?
Well, no, they'll drag it out some more. You see, political systems can sort of be undead for a really long time. And that's what the European Union will be. It'll be undead. But the point is, both the United States and Russia at this point are not interested in dealing with the European Union. They're interested in maybe dealing with Germany and France and Italy and various other countries, that significant other countries that make up the European Union, maybe, although they don't have very much to offer at this point. But they're not interested in dealing with Brussels. Clearly, that is not an entity that they favor or respect. So I don't know what more there is to say about it, except, you know, it's basically a bunch of people who get together and eat and drink wine and talk nonsense.
Can Ukraine avoid economic collapse as it faces war-related costs? And what's going on with immigration in Ukraine, with the human resources in Ukraine? What's your take on that? Because that would be important in the decisions that the West should make about Ukraine.
Well, the Ukraine no longer has an economy. It imports just about everything. There's no manufacturing. It's doing really badly with grain lately. It is exporting all the grain, and it's unclear what the people are going to eat. So there's going to be a problem, a food shortage problem that's coming up. This is from a country that is basically a grain basket country. An odd situation to be in, but basically it's being sustained by infusions of capital and weapons. Anybody who can escapes. People are trying to escape. So right now there's a certain age limit, how old you can be. So men can't leave, but women and children are leaving in drones. And young men, before they leave before they reach that age, they get out. And even the ones who can't legally get out try to escape somehow. Just walk out through the woods, you know, walk out of the country, and are often caught and killed in the process. So it's basically it's a destroyed country. It is already a destroyed country. There is no hope for the Ukraine. And the Russians will very slowly and gently pick away at it. And maybe 50 or 100 years from now, it'll be reabsorbed into Russia, which it had been part of in the ancient times, and then for the past 300 years, except for the past 30 years. So over the past few centuries, 10% of the time, the Ukraine was not part of Russia. That's not too big an effect.
How are, when it comes to the internal policies, or somehow the differences in Ukraine, do you think that these people who we call ultra-nationalists, who are against Russia, what is the percentage of the population who feel this way, who are against Russia? Do we know, do we have any information on that? Do we know how big they are in Ukraine?
Well, no, because there are a lot of people who basically go whichever way the wind blows. And there are a lot of them in the Ukraine. And because it is so far west and has been subjected to corrosive Western influences so much of the time, it is rather traditional in that part of the world for people to change their political orientations, like underwear or socks. It's really notable that, you know, a lot of these people who are based on their social media profiles are rabid Nazis with swastikas all over the place, then try to get into Russia and become Russian patriots and speak Russian and pretend that they've never spoken Ukrainian, etc. So that is a very typical thing. And when a Ukrainian says that he's a Nazi, don't believe him, because he may be saying that to basically get some money, because there's some Americans around who are giving money to Nazis, and some people want that money. And that's all it is. But the moment the money stops, the Nazism stops in a lot of ways. Now, there are a lot of people who are just basically mentally retarded to begin with. There's a problem with iodine in the drinking water, especially in the western parts of Ukraine, which causes people to not develop mentally. And a lot of these mentally underdeveloped people happen to be Nazis. There's no cure for them.
Yeah. We had NATO, we talk about NATO, but we had NATO participating effectively and actively in Ukraine against Russia. With the case of Iran recently between Iran and Israel, you see Israel fighting Iran, but after all, we know the plan, everything comes from NATO, the intelligence, everything, how they have been collaborating with Israelis, with Mossad, all of that. And we even Merz, Germany, together with the United States, provided Israel within for 10 days, they have provided 14 weapon shipments to Israel in order to make them capable to fight against Iran. It's not something between Iran and Israel. It's something between NATO and Iran. It's something between the West and Iran. It's something between the West and Russia. I think that China is on the waiting list right now. They know what's going on. And we had the defense minister of Iran together with Russia and China. They're going to meet in Beijing under SCO's framework.
Happening already.
Yeah, exactly.
That's happening.
Yeah. What's your take on the way that these three countries, which are important when it comes to BRICS, when it comes to SCO, and the future of a new world, what do they feel about the future? How do they want to deal with the United States and the West?
They don't really want to deal with the United States or the West. These countries, the combined West, are becoming borderline irrelevant. They're not quite there yet, but they're heading in that direction. If you look at a very basic statistic, which is the amount of electricity generated in the West versus the rest of the world, and the rest of the world is mostly Russia, China, India, big countries, and a few other countries, fairly large countries. Iran is one of them. If you look at electricity generation, around the year 2010, the lines crossed. The West continued to stagnate, whereas the rest of the world is growing. And right now, the rest of the world is generating twice the amount of electricity. By 2050, it'll be four or five times more than the West. And at that point, the West, where I think electricity consumption is going to drop, is just going to be dwarf economies that are no longer interesting. They'll basically be some services and some imports, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah. SCO and the way it works, is it going to be somehow similar or somehow help BRICS? Because it seems to me that SCO is better than BRICS when it comes to the way it works. Do you feel the same way?
No. BRICS is all about democracy and finance. So it's all about development programs and financial frameworks that avoid toxic currencies. Mm-hmm. It's very successful in that way. It's about bilateral trade. People get together and come up with all kinds of arrangements. SCO is a regional organization that encompasses specifically Eurasia, a big chunk of Eurasia. And it's about security. It's about military matters. So right now, for instance, I don't know if it's still ongoing, but yesterday it wasn't, going full steam. there was an SCO conference in Qingdao in China, and Defense Minister, Russia's Defense Minister Belousov was presenting. Iranian Defense Minister was there, and a lot of the sessions were closed. Most of the sessions were closed, but you can be pretty sure that there was thorough debriefing on the Israeli and American attacks and countermeasures. So the country to pay attention to is Iran, because Iran now realizes that it can't be left to its own devices in its area defense. And Russia, which has the world's most superior area defense systems, anti-rocket, ballistic rocket, and drone, anti-drone technology. So Iran is very good on the attack end of things. It has hypersonic rockets that, for instance, the West doesn't have. But it's not very good at area defense at all. So it was easy to penetrate. It couldn't do anything about it. Doesn't really have an air force. But it's if Iran had lots and lots of S-400 and S-500 systems, Russian ones, the Israelis would not be able to penetrate its airspace. And I'm sure there was also some discussion about the fact that, you know, Iraq and Syria are now basically, you know, doormats for anybody who wants to attack Iran. And that was a really bad mistake made by Pezeshkian and his people, because they thought that if they abandoned foreign policy in terms of military presence in the region, they could somehow sign deals with the West and have sanctions lifted and be happy and European and wear fancy suits and drink French liquor. So that's not happening. And so I'm sure that there'll be some major adjustments happening.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dmitry, for being with us today. Before wrapping up, let us know, how can we see your articles?
Again, go to boosty.to/cluborlov, C-L-U-B-O-R-L-O-V.
Right below your picture, you can see it. Yeah.
Very good. And subscribe. And later this weekend, I'm working on an article on how Iran won, in spite of all of these American and Israeli lies about how they actually did something other than, you know, fail miserably.
Thank you so much, Dmitry. Great pleasure as always.
Thank you.
See you soon. Bye-bye.